So this is the first Learn With Us with an accompanying optional video. So for my listeners on just audio here, you can follow along us without going on to the video that will be on YouTube, but it will help a little bit, but you'll still learn stuff from here. So today on the show, we have Rob Cameron. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Good, good. Thanks for coming on at such short notice. I think I only discovered the word Redwood.js yesterday, yeah.
Oh, really? Yeah, we've been out March 10th or 11th, I think, was our official launch date.
Okay.
So it's been a couple months now.
So Saturday, I was learning Saturday.js, Sunday.js, Monday.js, but today, instead of learning Tuesday.js, I'm learning Redwood.js.
Excellent, excellent.
So, tell us a little bit of your journey into where you're end up as a core developer, as one of your titles that you do.
Yeah, sure. So I'm in Southern California. I'm kind of near San Diego. And I met the founder of Redwood, who's also one of the founders of GitHub, Tom Preston Werner. We worked together, and this is in like 2002, 2003. We started working at the same company. And we both left that company since, of course. And then we've kind of gone off and done our own things, but we always remained really good friends. And yeah, about a year ago, he was showing me, he's like, hey, I'm working on this framework. It was called Hammer then, Hammer.js. He's like, would you be interested in working on this? And I was like, absolutely. I was a Ruby on Rails developer. And Tom as well, was Ruby on Rails. And he wanted to bring a lot of that Ruby on Rails feel, that convention over configuration. He wanted to bring that to the JavaScript world. So that really spoke to me in my Rails heart. So I was fully on board. And yeah, I've been working ever since. I built the website, did the tutorial. The generators were written by me, most of the form helpers. Again, that's a lot of the Rails influence, the generators and the form helper stuff. So yeah, I'm like, I don't know, a sixth of the code is probably me. another core member, Peter Pistorius, he's probably the other 5/6. He's amazing. He also worked with Tom at a previous company, Chatterbug, and he's since left Chatterbug, and now he's full-time on working on Redwood. Mm-hmm. And it's been an amazing journey. People seem to be really excited. And we're still working on new features. We're on version 0.12, I think, released last Thursday, and 0.13 will probably be this week.
Okay, cool. I just moved the windows up a little bit slightly, so I don't look like I'm standing at the floor, you know. This is my first time doing a video tutorial, whatever you want to call it, on with a live guest, so bear with me as I develop the stream quality setup on my windows, but at least you get to learn how I do the process, right? So like, you can see my little GarageBand audio here. Okay, so my experience with JavaScript roundabout has basically been React and Svelte and then jQuery and Ember.js. Now, the things that annoy me about maybe React and Svelte is like there's not like an official router out of the box. You had to dig around for a while, and you have optional routers. Like with Svelte, there's like three or four routers you can use, and I've kind of picked one, but it's not the same as what other people use. And I don't really like to have to think about these kind of things. I don't have to think about end-to-end testing and deployment. And like, the more that the developers of the framework think for me, the happier I am, because, you know, I read this quote on LinkedIn today is, I don't live to code, I code to live. So
that's good.
So from what my brief examinings of Redwood.js, for what it seems to me like is a very conventional approach, but it's not like extra too much to learn. You know, I just looked at some of the deck documents, some of the videos that you've made on YouTube. I'm not going to try and repeat that because it's been done already. I'm not going to reinvent the wheel. So anyone who wants to learn about Redwood.js properly, go on to Rob Cameron's YouTube channel and he will take you through the framework, stuff like that. But yeah, from what I initially saw of what you're doing, it seems like the initial project has a lot of stuff that's just good for production. You have like environment files set up for it. You have, I don't really know much about it, but I just, from a very brief overview, it seems pretty cool. So I've talked enough about it. Why don't you talk about it in a way that maybe you've not already repeated yourself on old podcasts, stuff like that. Anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's, you know, the four core members, me, Tom, Peter, and David Price. The four of us together probably have, I don't know, 70 or 80 years of, you know, development experience. So these little lessons that we've learned, we've all sort of baked into Redwood. So like you mentioned, the environment files, you know, there's plenty of routers out there, but we didn't really love the feeling that those routers gave you. Like they were a little verbose. So we actually created our own router for Redwood and we're constantly working on it, but we try to, you know, simplify it as much as we could. We had this idea of these named routes. So rather than, you know, peppering your actual URLs throughout your code /blog/4/blog/5, you use these named routes. So you say, I want to, you know, blog page, and you pass it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So if you ever change that route, you never have to change your code anywhere else because you're just using this name. As long as the name stays the same.
Is that name like a magic string?
No, it's actually a function name. If you go to, you can actually do a search up there at the top of the site. If you do a search for router, you probably find the router docs and you'll see some examples. Yeah, the Redwood router there.
Oh, I pressed enter. Right.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, click on that first one there.
This one, right?
Yep. Yeah, and then we have these concepts of constraints. So you can say, you know, the third part of the URL will be a variable that you want to call name. And, you know, that name should be a string. And now that's available to use later on in your code. Little kind of little convention over configuration, stuff like that.
Is it a TypeScript first framework or JavaScript?
We're working on that. So we started with JavaScript and we're converting everything over to TypeScript now. A lot of the generators now actually have a TypeScript option. So you can generate TypeScript if you like. And then once everything is 100% TypeScript, that'll become the default. And then you can choose to output to JavaScript if you want.
What about the pitfalls of TypeScript and that a lot of people don't know TypeScript and that will stop them coming to a framework and also increase the onboarding time?
Right. Yeah. There's been a lot of developers who asked specifically for TypeScript. Like I can't use this until it supports TypeScript. So that became a big priority for us just because, you know, you can always transpile TypeScript to JavaScript if you need to. So, you know, we've got that higher order type checking, you know, static checking everywhere. And then if you don't really care about that, that's fine. You can go down to JavaScript, but you can't go the other way. So we figured it'd be safer to start with TypeScript and then you can go down to the lowest common denominator if you would like to.
Is the framework written in TypeScript?
That's what the conversion process is now. So
right,
probably about half of it now is TypeScript and then the other half we're currently working on.
So you can understand how you'd use TypeScript to write a framework. But in terms of using a framework, I used to be a huge, huge TypeScript fanboy. Like,
yeah.
But I'm finding that a lot of like JavaScript has sort of fuzzy detection now and it can come up with like 70% of the sort of autocomplete on like WebStorm. You know, yep. I can fire up WebStorm here and people can just, you know, it is getting better and better, but obviously it's not like strict pure TypeScript. You know, you're going to have fuzzy matches, not complete matches, you know, but just JavaScript in a sense is that good with like just detecting stuff. And I can just basically like this here, like I can just press .space and it comes up with a bunch of stuff that's like, you know, it just knows that this is a Firebase project and it has like, I can go in here and parameterize, you know, look at parameters and stuff like that. Well, not as a function, but like there's like I can go into a function like, for example, this here. You already know this, but I'm just telling the listeners, and it'll tell me what the parameter is, and it's a JavaScript file. So, I mean, I just lost all my screens, so let me just put this in the back of down here somewhere.
Yeah, the introspecting that's built into editors now is amazing. How it can like deduce all that stuff and what's possible to go in there. So, yeah, and me personally, coming from a Ruby and a Rails background, like types, I don't really care about them. Like I've never needed them. So I'm not a huge TypeScript guy personally, but it just seems like that's the direction that the ecosystem is going in.
Right.
And people really do love it. So like I say, we're adding that support so that you can do TypeScript if you want. And if you don't want it, you can drop back down to JavaScript, but going the other way is much more difficult. So.
Yeah. Now I like this idea of a function. So this is a function here, some page, and that's the name of the route. And then you use that in your code somewhere, some page, which is a function that returns a link to a route? What's
that? Well, in that case, in that little code snippet there, some page is actually a component. It's a page component.
Right.
And we're just showing that the content of that page happens to be a link, and the link is to one of those named routes. So it's routes.home. So home is the name of the route there, that function.
So like a page component would be something like, in this Svelte project here, I have, this is not, this is a not a framework enforced pattern. This is a pattern I've just come up with Svelte. So I have this thing called root components, which have all these things like settings. And in settings, I will actually have links to the actual components, like, for example, email component, which is inside here. So you've kind of thought of that as just a framework, right?
Right. So that was actually one of the major motivations behind Redwood is, you know, every React app you go on is completely different because everyone sort of rolls their own way to organize all these directories, and some have pages and some don't, and components, some are in directories and some aren't, and it's like all over the place. So the idea with Redwood is here is a way to do it. We think it's a really good way to organize everything. We have these pages, we have layouts, we have components, they're in these named directories. Each component gets its own directory, and then its tests and storybook stories all live together with that component. And that way you can go from one Redwood app to another and you are completely comfortable. You know exactly where everything is and how it works, and you're good to go.
I just realized I wasn't recording the screen there. So now we're recording the screen. I'm recording the screen. So the first 4 minutes, I'll just put a big sign saying video recording at 4 minutes, something like that. I'm not going to repeat all that. I just sort of thought automatically that my screen's going to be recorded here because I'm sharing it. I almost did a podcast for an hour and a half and I forgot to record the other guy's audio, and I was like, whoops.
You know? Oh no. Yeah, we've got a double recording here, so we should be good.
Yeah, I mean,
for audio.
We're not like screen heavy.
Yeah.
So right. So it uses JSX.
It does, yeah, because it's just React. So all the components are React.
It's React.
It's not actually, it's not like a custom, you know, view framework like React. We use React, but our innovation is sort of combining that with GraphQL, and then we've got Prisma, and that's all out of the box. So you've got a front end and the back end together in Redwood. That's the kind
of. So it uses the whole virtual DOM thing?
Yeah, I mean, everything that React does, we're using that as the component builder, organizer. And so our router is just choosing which components to render, which we call them pages. It's kind of a higher level component that wraps the whole page.
So is it then something like, is it a little bit like Preact?
I'm not actually sure the difference between Preact and React. People have talked about that. Isn't Preact just a super lightweight?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
React. Yeah. But yeah, no, we've got the full on React is a dependency of our framework. If you go to, if you go to the tutorial, and it's either the second or the third step, we kind of have a little. Actually, I'm sorry. Go back to the homepage. The homepage has like kind of a,
yep,
illustration of how the framework is sort of organized.
Okay.
This isn't really going to help the audio listeners, but
yeah, this is a brand new MacBook Pro. This is a brand new MacBook Pro, and it's like struggling to record the screen here.
Yeah.
So back down, I'm at the homepage, redwoodjs.com. Yep.
Yep. Scroll down just a little bit in the main window there. Sorry.
Oh, the main window, right, okay.
Yeah, and you'll see a blue graphic, and you can click on that and kind of blow that up a little bit.
Okay.
Boy, it is slow trying to record, wow. Yeah, so the left side of this, right, you got the back end, front end, but that's all Redwood. So we have these, we call them sides. There's the web side, which is basically React, and then the API side, which is where you're writing your GraphQL queries, and then actual database access. So that's the whole thing. We call it full stack for the Jamstack. So, you know, classically Jamstack is like static files served over CDN, and that's it. And maybe they make requests out to something like Contentful, a CDN or a CMS to actually get the content and plug it into the page. But traditionally, those aren't worrying about an actual database. So we have, you know, Prisma is an actual SQL database client that can actually talk real SQL. And then you access that through GraphQL on the front end. So you've got your React making GraphQL calls, that's sort of as it moves over to the right, you can see there. So in the browser, right, we end up with React, and then React is making calls up through GraphQL to these serverless functions, AWS Lambda. So it basically runs like a little node script, runs it, and then as soon as it's done, it just goes away, and the Lambda closes. And by default, we ship with a GraphQL endpoint as one of these serverless functions, but you can write your own custom functions to do whatever you want.
So this is made for AWS?
We can deploy anywhere, technically, anything that kind of supports this like serverless idea, although that's a pretty flexible concept. You could create a, you know, Google Cloud platform worker that ran one of these functions. Mm-hmm. So on day one, when we shipped, we had built-in support to deploy to Netlify really easily. But we've since worked on, we've got Google Cloud Platform coming, Microsoft Azure, someone's looking at, Render.com, Vercel, who was Zite. They're working on theirs. And then we also want just a completely build your own deployment option too. So if you want to set up your front end as a CloudFront CDN in AWS and you want servers running in Google and you want something else over here, you can kind of combine those parts however you want.
Okay, cool. This is, so yeah. What's the difference between serverless and Jamstack?
So Jamstack is just more of a concept. I don't know if you remember like the LAMP stack, Linux. Yep. I forget what the LAMP even stood for. But the Jamstack is just another version of that. And it's JAMS, right? It stands for JavaScript, APIs, and Markup. So the idea is you've just got, you know, static HTML and potentially static JavaScript, like the React code, right? It's just still just a static JavaScript file. Mm-hmm. That comes down from a CDN super fast. You can have all these edges all over the world. So no matter where you are, you get your response in milliseconds. And then that JavaScript, the way it deals with dynamic data is by making API calls. And so the Jamstack doesn't really define what the backend is, it just says API. And in our case, that API is GraphQL and then a serverless function talking to SQL. But the serverless function part isn't really technically the concept of the Jamstack. We're sort of adding that in there.
Oh, it's a big project, man. Sheesh.
Yeah, it's like a full stack real framework that does everything, not just the traditional Jamstack front end.
In some ways, this reminds me of the serverless framework, which is a framework that basically you describe your services in YAML, and then it deploys mm-hmm. to AWS and all that stuff. But you're using Prisma, which is a different... It's like Prisma, and then you've got like... I don't know what I'm talking about, man.
It's all right. If you go through that, like the first couple steps of the tutorial kind of explain sort of the concept. There's a whole step in the tutorial called SideQuest, and it's how Redwood works with data. And we just have a big, you know, written out description of sort of how all this data moves back and forth. It's super confusing if you've never worked with any of this before.
Yeah.
Like a lot of people have, you know, are super familiar with React. They know nothing about GraphQL. They know nothing about Prisma or even databases in general. So it'd be a little bit more of a learning curve coming to Redwood.
Yeah. I've used GraphQL. I've used a lot of databases, and I've done some stuff with Lambda functions and also Google Firebase functions. But so, like, are you basically what I think you're doing is you're creating an AWS Lambda function which has a GraphQL endpoint, and then you have some SQL database on AWS. So you're not using NoSQL then?
Correct. Currently, we don't because we're relying on Prisma, and right now Prisma only supports SQL databases.
Right.
But I believe it's in their roadmap to support some NoSQL stuff. So you'd still use that same Prisma and Prisma syntax, but you just point it to like Mongo instead of MySQL. Probably have to be some changes there because Mongo is not going to have those, you know, referential joins between tables.
Yeah.
But same sort of idea. But the way Redwood is written, you could write a custom function that talks to NoSQL and do whatever you want. You don't have to use Prisma. You don't have to use GraphQL. We just ship with those in the box as sort of a pre-built solution, but you're free to do whatever you want for that backend.
So like when you go to make an app with SQL, you sort of, it's obvious how this schema should be. You have this table and you join it together and you can have an XML column in there if you want to do like arbitrary stuff. But with I'm still learning about how to do NoSQL stuff with Firebase, but it just seems like you can do whatever you want. It's like the Wild West. You're just like, yeah, stick it in there, store it there, put some index on this, and then you can treat it like a... So, like, I don't know. It's hard enough.
Yeah, the traditional... Right, it's traditionally just like a big JSON document, and it can have any format you want, and it can link to any other document that has any other format you want. So it's a whole different way to think about database organization on the back end. Mm. And again, we're not focused on that right now. We're focused on more of the traditional SQL stuff. But you absolutely could. Use that for a backend if you wanted. You could keep the GraphQL part and have your GraphQL, they call them resolvers. That's where you actually say, hey, GraphQL, when I say I want a username, the resolver describes how to actually get that username from somewhere in the world and return it to GraphQL. So you could have that resolver do whatever you want. We just have it talk to Prisma. We wrap the Prisma calls in what we call services. We actually have another graph. There's a graph in the tutorial that kind of describes how the GraphQL and the services sort of play together.
Okay, okay. So this is going to appeal to people at the moment that have a lot of normal SQL database experience. So in AWS, what is the SQL service?
If you want to live in the AWS ecosystem, so they have RDS, the Relational Database Service, mm-hmm. and they have Postgres, they have MySQL. There might be a couple more in there now. I think there's a Windows SQL Server you have to get a license for or something. And then they have their own version called Aurora, which is MySQL compatible, but it's supposedly five times more performant. Mm-hmm. So if you want to stay in AWS world, you would go with one of those. During the tutorial, we actually recommend you stand up a Postgres instance on Heroku because it's completely free and you can run it forever for free. Whereas AWS, you have to kind of be very familiar with how AWS works and set up security groups and permissions and IP addresses. And Right. So we skipped over all that. So that's one of the major things that's missing now in sort of this vision that we have, that Redwood has, is you've got the CDNs, which are on the edge right to your door. You've got these AWS Lambdas, which are deployed all over the world right to your door. But databases, that nut still hasn't been cracked yet. A database is like one big server sitting in Oregon somewhere, and the whole world has to access it. So there's a couple of different people, like FaunaDB is one. There's a couple of people that are working on these distributed databases. So it's still SQL, but it kind of lives everywhere around the world for faster access. Uh-huh. That isn't quite ready yet. We're so close. That's the missing part to make Redwood really shine. Like that's Tom calls this. He sees this maybe in 5 or 10 years. He calls it the universal deployment machine. So you basically just write your code and you push it to GitHub, and this universal deployment machine figures out where to put your code, what services need to be created to talk to each other, where the database needs to go, how the data, and you don't worry about any of that. You don't worry about CPUs or memory or disk space, nothing. It's just all handled for you. So we're hoping that's coming soon, and having a database that does that, that is deployed to this edge, is one of these steps to get to that universal deployment machine. If you go to that, yeah, see on the site there, if you go to SideQuest, how Redwood works with data, a few up from where your mouse is.
Yeah.
So then there's another little graphic in here that tries to describe what is living in this AWS Lambda. So there's the browser, and the browser is making a GraphQL call. GraphQL payload goes across the internet and then goes into this Lambda function. And there's in the code base, it's literally GraphQL.js that gets wrapped up in this Lambda function.
Yeah.
And we have these SDL files that describes what your GraphQL looks like, what it can return, and what it accepts as parameters. Uh-huh. And then the resolver is written in these services. So the PostJS service is the resolvers for the GraphQL. And that service is what talks SQL out to the world, to the database. And you're free to create your own custom function, do whatever you want. It can do anything. We just ship with this GraphQL function by default so that you have a GraphQL API ready to go out of the box. And you'll see, if you go through the tutorial and build it, like there's really no configuration to get all this working. It's just sort of there, and you're just writing the code for what you want to return, and things just magically work.
Yeah.
It's amazing. So it's a lot of concepts to absorb all at once, too.
So the most advanced that I got into SQL was that I was using C# in the Entity Framework, and they had these migrations, which was very quirky. But eventually mm-hmm. I managed to understand how it works. But it's basically what it is it creates update statements for changing the schema.
Yep.
Are they quite similar, the migrations from that, from something like the migrations in Entity Framework, if you have experience with that?
Absolutely, actually. So Prisma has a part of their framework called Migrate, and there is a single file, schema.prisma, and that is your database schema, what you want it to look like in like its final state. So what you do is, as you make changes to that file, you say, okay, I made a change, I want to create a migration. So it creates a series of steps that needs to transition the database from what it did look like to what you want it to look like right now today. Right. And then it applies that migration, it applies those update statements against the database. Mm-hmm. And so as you're building your app, you're making these migrations one after the other as your data sort of evolves, and you're running these migrations one after the other. And you're doing it locally in development as you're developing, but then when you deploy, it'll run on your deployment process and migrate the production database as well.
Yeah. There were so many times when I was designing this app with Entity Framework that I'd be having this sort of stack of migration files, and it sort of bugged me that I had all this legacy information about the database, and a lot of times I just wiped everything and then just did a fresh one. So I just had, you know, do people find a little bit like that with Redwood? They just get tired of the migration files getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger.
Well, we haven't got to that problem yet in Redwood. It's still fairly new. Like, I'm working on an app as part of my day job, and there's like six migration files, and it's a single directory, and in that directory I think is three or four files, including like a README that describes what is going to happen and what changes are going to be made. It's pretty neat. Rails has come up with a solution for this, where it's like, I forget the name of the package, but it's like a migration compressor. So it'll basically run through all your migrations and just create one single migration that is all of those previous ones down into one. So some people will compress them by year. So here's all the data changes from 2016, all of them from 2017. So now you end up with four migration files. So you still have a history of how your data has changed over time. Like, if you don't really care about that, then just toss it out. You don't care.
But what if you have a developer that needs an incremental update? You meant to lose some information there.
Well, when you do that compression, of course, all those migrations are still there. They're just now in one file instead of 100 separate files.
Right, I see.
Yeah. It still runs. Yeah, they still all run one after the other.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you don't technically lose any data, but it definitely cleans up that migrations directory from hundreds.
But you hope that those migrations work across database versions.
Well, yeah. That gets into even more complexity. Yeah. We're talking like now about...
Go ahead. Something like FaunaDB, which is quite new... As that advances, then you'd think that a lot of that stuff would break, potentially, the update statements for the database.
That's true. It could, right? Maybe they release, you know, whatever version they're on, they'd release the next major version, and half those database migration commands are different now, and they don't work. So that's a kind of a problem you'll have to worry about in the future. Like, every once in a while, you know, go through, pretend you're a brand new developer starting from scratch, run all your migrations and see what works and what doesn't work. I've had that even on old Rails apps, where I've had hundreds and hundreds of migrations, and the database structure has changed so much, or the model is being referenced in the database migration, and now that migration won't run anymore. So I'll go in, even if it's like a four-year-old migration, I'll have to go in and like tweak that migration just a little bit so it still does what it was intended to do 4 years ago, but so that a new developer can run it from scratch and it still works. Yeah, that's fun. That's when you get to the real problems of big legacy apps.
Mm-hmm. So I'm surprised that this is more the React than I thought it was. In a sense, you can take all your React skills, Thunk and Sagas and Jest and all that stuff, and you can just use this, and you get basically an opinionated layer which helps structure your React app. Plus, you have this full stack deployment system, which means you don't.
Yep.
You can fire some back. I mean, sorry, you can.
Well, let's not say fire anybody, but. Yeah. You can become more efficient at your own job, yes. But yeah, that's the idea. Like, it's just React, so you can plug in your React stuff. Jest testing we have kind of throughout now, so you'll see as you use some of our generators, those, it's just kind of convenience things for creating these React components, these things like we call pages and layouts, and we have these things called cells. The generator just makes that sort of boilerplate structure for you, but you could just plug in existing React code if you have it somewhere.
You generate Jest test. I like the sound of that, because... That stuff is boring to write.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have another generator called a scaffold. So it'll basically give you the CRUD operations for accessing a single table.
Yeah.
Like, that's still right there. So let's say you create a new user table, and you know, one of the most annoying parts about being a developer is you create this new table and now you got to get data in there. So now do you open up a SQL GUI, or are you writing SQL on the command line? So we have these what are called scaffolds, and it's basically like a table-based view of all your data in your user table and a form to add users. So it makes it really easy to put new data in and out of the database real quick as you're testing. And if you'd like, you can take that scaffold and sort of modify it and tweak it and use it in your real app, or you could maybe move it to your admin section, or maybe just delete it and you don't really care about it anymore. If you go to, I'm trying to remember where we do this at, where we create the scaffold, maybe in Getting Dynamic. Go down to the Getting Dynamic thing. Yeah. Sorry again for audio only listeners. But if you scroll through here, you might see some screenshots of what the finished scaffolds look like.
I've got like a 3 second ping here on my laptop.
Yeah, it's really weird how much longer it's taking to render it. I don't know if it's because of the recording or what.
It's probably, if I use something like OBS, it's probably more efficient at recording the screen.
Ah, yeah.
But this is just,
you'll see here, here's this creating the database schema. So if you keep going here a little bit, you'll kind of see a screenshot of this prisma.schema file. And you create this model, they call them models. So we're creating this model post and ID title body, and you define the data types.
How is this defined as a primary key? Is this by ID? Is that it?
Yep. Yeah, so saying at ID lets it know that's the primary key. And then at default is here's what you pre-fill that field with if there's no other data. In this case, it's an auto-incrementing field. And there's a default, right? It'll default timestamp to now. Those are like special triggers in Prisma. Prisma knows how to deal with those special names.
And I guess you have foreign key stuff and...
Yeah, so I can't remember if we do it in the tutorial, but yeah, later on there's like a... You can do relationships between. So you have a user who has many posts, and you define that, you know, user.post should return an array of posts, and post.user should return a user, and it links back and forth. So here, now we've generated the scaffold. So you get this plain screen because you don't have any data yet.
Wow.
Yeah.
We're generating code now.
Yeah, yeah. And again, this is, you know, you don't have to use this.
It brings tears to my eyes.
This is bad. Happy tears or bad?
Tears of joy.
Oh, good. Yeah, this is a very famous part of Rails, like creating these scaffolds. And you'll find, like, as a Rails developer, you know, after you're using Rails for 6 months, you probably don't really use the scaffolds anymore. But when you're just starting out, oh man, they're like a lifesaver. So if you keep going, you'll see more screenshots of what the form looks like. Yeah, so here's like creating a new post. You get a form.
Good stuff.
All your fields. Yep. Well, we're using, technically, it's like Tailwinds. I don't know if you're familiar with Tailwind CSS.
Even better.
Yeah, dang, we sort of borrowed there. Tailwind isn't, we haven't taken a real hard stance on CSS yet. I just
getting my cool glasses on now, talking about Tailwind.
Nice. But yeah, so I use Tailwinds to style these scaffolds, but Tailwinds is not built into the framework. You can add it, though, pretty easily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Tailwind's great. I love it. It's great.
Yeah, yeah. Now, our real innovation, if you want to see the real future, if you go to Cells. Cells is sort of our innovation on top of how React renders components.
Yep.
So a cell, you know, a typical component has this life cycle, right? So if a component needs data, there's going to be a loading state because it doesn't have the data yet. And if you don't have any data, you probably want to show some kind of a thing that's like, oh, there's nothing here yet. Kind of like we're doing that scaffold. Says create one. You want to create, you want to create one. There's maybe has to render something if there's a problem, if there's an error somewhere. And then finally, there's like the final state, the happy path, everything worked. Here's what to render this. So we've sort of codified all that into this concept of a cell. And a cell is just renders components, but they have special names there. You can see there's loading. So it'll render the loading component while it's in a loading state. It'll render empty if there is no records. It'll render failure if there's a problem. And finally, it'll render success. And success as a prop is given the data that was returned from the GraphQL. So you actually define your query. So you define the data, the loading, the empty, the failure, and the actual success state. So everything about how to draw this component is in that one file. And we call those cells. And it's hard to describe.
You also generating tests for this, like Jest tests?
You know we are.
This is ridiculous.
I know, right? That's why it's the best framework ever. Yeah, so and then now we just... Storybook integration just went into master. So I don't know if you're familiar with Storybook, but you can build your kind of component in it's like its own little universe, and you can give it test data, and you can render out every possible state depending on what those data attributes are. And you have this nice little GUI for rendering it and actually plugging data in and out and doing all these little test parameters. And our vision for a workflow is you generate your component, you go into Storybook, you design it, you get it to look, you get it looking exactly the way you want. You rate your tests for it. And now you just plug that component into your real app wherever you want it to go, and it just everything works. So you're not building your component inside your other components and inside your pages and inside your layout and have to worry about all this stuff rendering correctly. You just build it in Storybook in its own little universe, and then you plug it in when you're done. And it just everything magically works. And you can do that now. Like that's what you can do with Storybook and React today. But
okay,
you have to set that up manually.
So there's a lot of moving parts here, a lot of complexity that makes our lives easy as developers, if it all works. But if something goes wrong at one point, there's going to be some pain because...
Everything's custom.
You know, there's a lot of steps there that have to work together. Or if one point, you know, it's going to be hard to... If you have this process that follows from testing and deployment and building and that, what comfort can you give to us startups and project managers that want to keep our jobs, they want to have something stable long term that we can trust and not have to rewrite in 2 or 3 years?
Right.
That's a horrible question, by the way.
Yeah, thanks for that, by the way. Yeah, I mean, well, we're not going anywhere. We've got an extremely active community. There's like, I think 60 people now have contributed, have had pull requests merged. We've got a very active community message board where tons of troubleshooting people are kicking in help all the time. You can always open issues on the site and you'll get a response within hours or an hour usually. We recently added two more core members. We don't have like official names for them yet, but there's a couple other guys, Dominic and Robert, who just contributed a ton of good code. Robert's like our testing guy. He's the testing master. So he's added all these Jest tests. Dom is like an extremely good writer. So he's writing all kinds of documentation and stuff. So we're taking these people that are giving us a lot of contributions and bringing them into the core group. So they're making decisions with us. They're committing their own code. They're committing other people's code. Yeah, JTOR and Robert Burisma are our other two.
Man, that is a ridiculous spread of contributors. That is really good. Because one of these things about frameworks, you get like two guys at the top and the rest are like...
Oh, no, we've got, tons of guys who are all over it. Yeah, people love it.
Sheesh.
Yeah, Kim Adelaine, she's in Microsoft. So she's kind of getting us some Microsoft connections. She's looking at Azure for us, and she's also a TypeScript expert. There's a couple, when we very first launched, we had some issues with Windows, but we've got a couple Windows people now who have cleaned all that stuff up. Yeah, I mean, everyone seems really excited and really happy to be in. The community's great. Everyone's friendly and happy, and it's been amazing. So I don't think we're going anywhere anytime soon.
What kind of tests do you have to make sure this whole thing works, like from start to finish? Nothing, you know.
So the one thing we just added, Peter just added this for us, is we have a whole Cypress test suite for the tutorial itself. So every time we make a release, it basically runs through the entire tutorial to make sure the tutorial still works. That's sort of everyone's first step into Redwood. And that's where you get that syndrome where, you know, if you try something out and it doesn't work, you're like, forget it. You'll never try it again. So the tutorial is our entryway. We want to make sure that entryway is always clean and nice and beautiful and gets everyone from end to end perfectly. So that tutorial test suite is like our major thing. And we also, there's also integration and unit tests throughout the code base itself. But making sure the tutorial works 100% is our sort of our main focus.
So
right
when
now.
You say tutorial works 100%, do you mean the end product of the tutorial, or do you mean the build steps to get the tutorial to production?
No. Yeah, it goes through every step. It doesn't deploy it. We're not testing like deployment right now.
Right.
But it goes through of like the first step of the tutorial, you write some code, does it work? You add a form field, does that form field work? So it doesn't just test the final state, it tests like each step through the thing to make sure it works.
Right, right.
It's really, really nice, yeah.
Well, there you've got the
what
guy.
Else you got? What else you got?
The dude
it's
there.
Was it? Yeah.
Tom Preston Werner.
Yes, he was one of the co-founders of GitHub. He created a semantic versioning, if you're familiar with that. He created that spec for saying, you know, like major.minor.patch.
Yeah.
The TOML configuration sort of language spec thing, TOML, that's his. Jekyll, the static site generator, that was Tom's. So many, many of his projects have had a very long life, so I wouldn't worry about Redwood going anywhere anytime soon.
And there's Rob.
There's me.
Amateur radio. Nice.
Yeah. I haven't been on in a while. I got to pull my radio back out. It's on my shelf back here.
I was in an iPhone shop trying to get my iPhone repaired. And it's amazing the tools that you plug into the iPhone, sort of like the things you can plug into a car to make sure the car's not been modified. And but I've got a perfectly good iPhone, but the... So at this point, when I touched the iPhone, the computer and my H4N mic and everything that could have went wrong, and I sat for about 5 minutes trying to fix things. So decided that actually we'll have enough material for a part one and we'll do a part two at some point later in a few days. So thank you for being with us, and until next time. Bye-bye.